This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about drugs and alcohol in D&D and other games. Like, how are intoxicating substances represented in myth and fiction? Are there rules in D&D for handling inebriated characters? And how can you handle players who partake at the table? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the details of drugs and alcohol in D&D, I want to remind everyone very quickly that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our After Party Chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, which is available to all of our patrons. So you can join in by simply becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join in at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get all that done before around 2 o'clock Eastern, maybe 10 after, and Dan and I will be there to host the After Party Chat.
We love that every week, so we hope you've shown up. So, Paul, what a great time. I'm almost surprised we haven't dealt with drugs and alcohol in D&D. It's, possibly a sensitive issue, right? It's probably not for every gaming group do you want it part of its session, but it's a really common theme in mythology and, Norse fighters. And, some people call D&D a beer and pretzels game. And almost the traditional most common starting point is you all meet together in a tavern drinking together. How every D&D game is supposed to start. So, of course, we should deal with this.
Sure. And yeah, like you said, it's a beer and pretzels game, right? I've certainly played plenty of games where it's just casually available at the table to the players. And it comes up. It comes up sometimes in play. You may remember, if you've watched 10 Dead Rats, which was largely a Warhammer, live play Warhammer role-playing game that I hosted, that was largely based on the Enemy Within, but I gave the players broad leverage to add or remove stuff or go in different directions, whatever they wanted. And the major subplot they ended up inventing was a drug smuggling subplot. So that was kind of their addition to the game. And there is a little bit of thematic content in that particular series, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. That is vaguely drugs and alcohol related. But also I've had games where players just thought it made sense for their characters to get drunk at this point, sometimes in hilarious ways and sometimes in less hilarious ways. Dan,
I've done that myself. I will say maybe you're remembering the character that I played that was in one of our campaigns, a depressed tavern guard who was down on his luck with his job and basically spent all of his time inebriated to get over the bad job that he had, more or less. So I've certainly done that as a primary character point.
Yep. We encountered this just recently, Dan, in a game I think I ran, trying to remember where this came up, but like there's a theme sometimes in mechanically, when you look at like mechanics around drugs and alcohol, specifically around like berserker types. A lot of times you see things like, right, whether it's the Warhammer Troll Slayer, or I remember in second edition D&D playing a character who was the Berserker Dwarf class or kit that I'm trying to remember, which I can't unfortunately recall what they were called. But specifically, like, sometimes they had triggers of like, in order to ramp yourself up into this state, you have to take in a lot of alcohol or other substance.
I was thinking very much the same thing. And of course, very early on in D&D, people were producing berserker alternative characters. I mean, actually, it's one of the first monsters, right? So the very first monster in original D&D is men with several subtypes, including berserkers. So it's a really major tentpole of the mythology and the fiction. And it's, a major point of berserkers mythologically that they were probably, you know, imbibing substances to make them go berserk. And so the berserker class, that optional class you're talking about, things in first edition, like magic items that give berserker powers, like there's a ring of berserk strength that will boost your strength and your constitution to 18, but also make you unable to avoid melee. And every opponent you ever see, you're going to run into melee to the death automatically out of control. So that's clearly, if it's not explicit, it's clearly at least a metaphor for being tuned up on some kind of substance that you're in a different state of mind.
Yeah. You know, we're going to talk about a lot of, there's questions showing up in the chat about like, where are we going with this topic? We're going to talk a lot about like all the right of like rules around inebriation, rules around addiction, and you know, both yeah. you know, in the game, and then I think we'll focus mostly in the game, but we're going to talk a little bit about just at the table as well. It was when this topic was announced, there was actually some fairly interesting chat going on in our Discord server around rules for addiction, right? Just general rules for addiction and how does that work? And I can think of now, I'm just off the top of my head, I can now think of at least three D&D adventures that feature some kind of mind altering substance that the players may partake in that is going to affect things, right? There's things like I was just talking about in Warhammer, there's obviously Warpstone, right? Warpstone is a big deal and it's a major part of like Skaven culture that they actually consume the Warpstone and it makes them, you know, well, it's got pros and cons, right? It gives them extra abilities and it also like is highly addictive and causes problems. And that the second adventure in the Enemy Within series has a plot line of a town where there is a doctor who is trying to help the townspeople with what ails them. They all seem to be, you know, afflicted with something, and he's got this this cure-all, this you know, liquid cure-all that he's passing around, which spoiler alert, turns out to be something infused with a little bit of Warpstone powder.
And then he's giving everybody. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah,
that's kind of. I did not know that was a major part of Warhammer lore.
That is the hook that my players ran with, and we actually twisted it in 10 Dead Rats. We actually twisted it, I think, into being more of a thing. I think I invented a specific drug that they were manufacturing, but then the players got involved and the whole drug ring of the manufacture and distribution of this drug.
Interesting. Interesting.
There's a D&D one shot that I love running that I've run at a few cons called Citadel of the Severed Hand, which is a little raid on a fortress created by orcs. And there's a side entrance you can go through where there's some mushrooms growing and you can eat them and you can roll on a chart to see what happens when you do.
I think I have that. I think that's an element. That same kind of element is like on the first level of my mega dungeon personally. Have that same kind of thing as well. Yeah.
And then I feel like I have to point out, Dan, that you and I wrote a whole adventure on this show, WDM 01, about a bunch of berserkers who inhale strange gas that they keep in little pods, little leather, you know, containers that they inhale to make them berserk.
You know, I actually didn't remember that prepping for this show. I'm glad you brought that up. And you know, in my mega dungeon on a lower level, there's also like a tainted well that the berserkers there are using to tune themselves up. So apparently, so you meet in a tavern. Encounter number one is you fight some giant rats. That was a couple episodes ago. You can go back and see that. And then encounter number two is you encounter some berserkers that are tuned up on some kind of substance. I mean, that's just classic D&D right there is what that is.
It is. You know, so this is, I would point out, like, what we're getting at here is there's certainly a common trope here of a mind-altering substance that gives a temporary quick boon right away when first taken on, right? Something that causes you to berserk, that you, you know, get extra, you know, benefits to attack or temporary hit points or who knows what, right? That kind of stuff. And then usually there's a withdrawal, right? Oftentimes they include like, and then when you come down, there's this, you know, it's a double-edged sword in some way, or there's the, you know, you lose coherence, right? So you're attack at random or you can't stop attacking. Right.
Right.
So I think those are fairly common tropes in the game.
And I certainly can't help but, you know, think about the fantasy character of Elric. Of course, we were fortunate enough to have Mr. Michael Moorcock on the show about a month ago. And of course, my first encounter with Elric was, I'll confess, in the D&D, D&Ds and Demigods book. And it's about a page long description. And the very first paragraph is, here's Elric's ability scores if he has his strength boosting drugs available. And here's his much, much lower ability scores on the 15% chance that he doesn't have them available when you meet him. So you have this really canonical fantasy character who's almost entirely dependent on strength-altering drugs for his physical power. And I think, you know, generally speaking, I think these things tend to get softened a little bit over time. So if I recall correctly, like in the literature, Elric had drugs in the early writings, and then they became potions later on. They became magical potions to help him out. And so maybe just magical potions in general is a metaphor for physical alterations from drugs. Actually, you get it from an alchemist. Be nice to have it. At some point, your players are really dependent on it, frankly, just game mechanical purposes. So potions themselves, you can kind of read they're drugs.
Yeah, so that's the major thread that I saw happening on our Discord server was around the addiction rulings, right? Now, like right. I said, in this trope, I think we very often see that, you know, a withdrawal symptom or a penalty that goes along with the benefit, like you can't, you know, discern friend from enemy or whatnot. But I think it's much more rare to see a good or any treatment of long-term addiction.
I see this, and I think that it may, and I can point to at least one place that I think has pretty promising rules for that. And I think the fact that the publishers shy away from this topic a little bit leaves that as a bit of a lacuna, a little bit of a gap. That they tend not to go into that little level of detail because they don't want so much space in the book taken up to the subject. So I can see that as a weak point historically in the rules mechanics, because I agree that's a potentially really interesting element to dig into in the game.
Yeah, and I think that more often they approach it from a magical direction, right? Like, okay, it's a little disturbing to talk about this for regular old drugs, but like, let's talk about the corrupting force of, say, carrying the One Ring, or having an intelligent sword that wants to do something different from you, or, you know, that kind of thing, or very much in the Warhammer section, right? Like getting slowly addicted to Warpstone and using its ability to power your magic and then, you know, becoming corrupt, right? Corruption. That's it. That's, you see that in DCC as well, right? Right. Like, oh, you're meddling with powers that are giving you these magical powers, but you're becoming more and more corrupt as you work with this stuff.
I will point out that Elric gets it from two directions, if not actually three. So he needs physical drugs that he imbibes for his strength. He has a corrupting, intelligent sword that makes him do things that he doesn't want to. And he's also summoning demons all the time. So he's really got it coming at him about at least three ways, right?
So Elric
he's really
is
leading
your,
into
your
it.
prime example for addictive substances. That's fascinating.
I mean, just look at the guy. He doesn't look well, really. He really needs a sandwich. He doesn't look great. So, anyway, so let that be a lesson to you kids.
I think that stuff's interesting. It's fascinating, but it's usually tied to very specific class types, right? It's usually tied to like you're a berserker, shaman, whatever. You're a witch doctor who deals with powers he shouldn't. What about like good
third
old
third edition had a drunken master monk class? Sorry to interrupt. There's a drunken master monk class in third edition. Yep.
So what about good old inebriation though? What about like, yeah, our characters just think like now is a good time for us to go get drunk.
Let me pull up some mechanics if I can. You know, so sure, I did a little search, and I guess in retro, I shouldn't have been surprised. I actually shouldn't have been surprised, but I was, that the only edition of D&D that has rules for inebriation of any sort is only first edition. And I have that. I cut that out. It's got the orange dot on it for this image. Sure. So I had, you know, having, you know, learned with first edition, I actually had the instinct that this was part of every rule set for D&D, and it isn't. Here we're looking at the first edition Advanced D&D Dungeon Master's Guide, and there is a short couple paragraphs on the effects of alcohol and drugs, kind of loose, kind of subjective. So here you're looking at Gary Gygax's intoxication table. Doesn't matter what the substance is. Could be alcohol, narcotics, similar drugs, right? That's all he says about it. And the DM can peg you at one of three states of intoxication, slight, moderate, or great. And each of them has effects on increases your bravery and morale. Now, that's for NPCs only. And then mostly has a bunch of increasing penalties on your ability scores. So your intelligence and your wisdom starts declining catastrophically, frankly. Your dexterity and your charisma go away. Your attack dice start to get really bad. And then right at the end, you gain a couple of hit points. You gain just a couple of hit points, which is interesting. And then there's a separate table for like time to recover and stuff like that. So very loose, very subjective, but this doesn't exist in any other edition of D&D. And I guess I shouldn't be too surprised by that, because when second edition came out in the late 80s, that was the height of the culture wars. And they really scrubbed the rules from a lot of potentially contentious subject matter. So assassins got deleted, monks got deleted, demons and devils got deleted out of the rules. The alcohol rules here got deleted. And while some of those other things were brought back, these results never did back into any core rules. So second, third, fourth, fifth, there's no mechanics whatsoever in the core books for anything about alcohol or drugs.
I mean, even this, I find I mean, it's interesting that it's applying minor effects to, you know, your mm-hmm. core stats, your attacks, your intelligence, your charisma, sure. But like, I guess I'm always looking for something that's going to more affect player behavior, right? Something that where mm-hmm. you're going to, something that's more akin to, say, like a charm effect, right? When you're charmed by a mm-hmm. monster, you know, you're fighting a vampire and he charms your frontline fighter. Like, that feels more like, okay, now we're like, I want something that maybe pulls a little agency away from the player, right? That's what I'm looking for. And I don't feel like anything has ever really given us that.
Now, at some point, the player falls unconscious. The character. So at some point here, if you get right, there's an asterisk on great here. So once you get past that, your character is unconscious. So that takes away some agency. But that's probably not what you're talking about. So one thing I saw, you know, usually these rule sets, if it's not in the core rules, maybe there's some kind of supplement or there's some kind of third party accessory of various types that suggest things. So one thing that did catch my mind is in the third edition era, Monty Cook, who's a great designer and one of the three main people who designed third edition in the first place, kind of late into that era, he had an official Dungeons and Dragons book that he wrote called the Book of Vile Darkness. And of course, that's named after a classic magic item. And it was, you know, it's very edgy, it was a very dark cover. It had a stamp on the cover that said, "For mature readers only, caution," all this kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And he very much dug into, you know, evil sorcery and demonic possession and, you know, blood rituals and also drugs and alcohol, which, you know, were pretty furiously not part of the main D&D line. And so I'll say Monty Cook really thought about it. This seems like probably about the best thought out set of rules. It's several pages in the Book of Vile Darkness. And I'll also say that Monty also heavily uses drugs in his Tolus campaign, which was the test bed campaign for third edition, as a matter of fact. So he spent quite some time thinking about this. If you pull up the image with the yellow dot, he has a list of numerous different, you know, intoxicating substances that are fictional in the Book of Vile Darkness. And I just pulled up one just for consideration. So here is Monty Cook's mushroom powder for third edition type rules. Taken from a rare blue mushroom, this powder must be inhaled. It is popular among arcane spellcasters. So you have one effect, which is a +2 bonus to intelligence and charisma for an hour. There's a secondary effect of 1 point of strength damage. And then there's side effects of, it's a mild hallucinogen. So you have another penalty that, lasts longer. Your wisdom goes down after some hours. Your strength and constitution go further down. And then there's also a rule here for possible overdose and just take out flat out hit point damage if you take too much of it. And so he's got a list of probably about a dozen substances that like this have maybe one kind of positive effect and one kind of negative effect and some kind of risk and some kind of reward. And so I feel that, you know, compared to like the AD&D core rules, which is just like, here's the modifiers, the end, this gives the players something, you know, something to risk and reward, something to think about, you know, possibly putting themselves in some amount of peril for a benefit. And I can't say, as I've tested this myself, sometimes these things surprise me in play with results that I don't expect, but I would consider trying this, putting this in front of the players and seeing how they interact with it.
I mean, again, what I'm seeing ultimately is the majority of the effects here are impact on your ability scores, which, depending mm-hmm. on what version of D&D you're playing, is going to have minor to no effect, right, on actual gameplay.
This is a good point. And the other thing is that I will also say, I've gotten away from ability score modifiers because they're also just kind of a pain to handle the table. You're two steps removed from, like, there's the ability score goes down, and then at least particularly in first edition, when you have non-linear modifiers, then you have to go consult a table to, like, if my dexterity goes down by how many points, what does that do to my AC modifier? And then I can go actually change my AC at that point. So I also agree that maybe ability score modifiers are maybe not the very best mechanic. I would do it slightly differently with the end results would be in front of me. But, you know, interesting. Now, the thing that's more interesting to your point, Paul, if you bring up the green dot, is that part of these rules in Book of Vile Darkness is that there's a general mechanic for addiction. And this is the thing that I don't see in a lot of rules presentations. Yeah. Certainly was never part of mainline D&D core rules. So here, what Monty does is he more or less borrows the rule similar to disease. Drug addiction functions much like diseases. And what's going to happen is that every time you use one of those selection of drugs for some benefits, you have to make a fortitude save at one of these numbers on screen, somewhere between 4 and 36. So basically, you know, totally trivial to completely impossible. If you fail it, then you need to keep taking the drug every day or 2 or 5 or 10. And if you fail to take the drug in that time span, then ability score damage, increasing the ability score damage. And I think if I recall, if you make 2 saving throws in a row, then I think you shake the addiction, I think, is what we've got there. So I've certainly never seen addiction rules for D&D anywhere, you know, closer. So this is one of the actual designers of the rule set. And this would probably be the thing that I would pick first. I guess if I needed to start using drug rules in my game, I guess I might try this and see how I should modify it.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea of the addiction rule saying basically that, you know, you're going to get these penalties unless you keep taking the drug. I think that's pretty clever, right? That definitely drives the feel of addiction. So I think that's pretty good.
Right.
Again, I'm disappointed that the effect is ability score damage. I feel like there's got to be something better than ability score damage.
Yeah. And I certainly this is a legacy from Gary in first edition. That was the first thing that he went to. You know, maybe ability scores were, you know, maybe he house ruled use of them in a different way. Maybe he was doing like D20 under the score a lot. So clearly this is the habit at the time. I'm slightly surprised at this date that Monty Cook hadn't transitioned to something else at this point. So I agree the ability scores are going to be a little bit of a drag to manage. As Hoboger saying in the chat, don't modify the ability scores, just give adjustments to the relevant roles in game. And I do agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Interesting. Let me give you a specific situation here, Dan. So, I had a campaign that I was running where the players arrived at a town, and it had taken a fair amount of effort to get there, so they were feeling like, "Woohoo, we did it, we made it." And so they decided to go to this tavern and drink. And they're just at the table, just randomly role-playing themselves drinking and deciding amongst themselves how inebriated to behave, how to portray that in their role-play, which is great. I'm all for that. And as they're role-playing this, they're also discussing some of the leads that they had heard recently, and specifically they were under the impression that there was a vampire problem somewhere around here. Now, they were fairly low-level, probably too underpowered to take on a vampire. But as they roleplayed getting more and more drunk, they decided more and more that it would be a great idea to go out and look for the vampire. And they were all incredibly pleased with the humor as players. They were all incredibly amused by the idea that they were drunk and deciding that, yes, late at night while drunk is the perfect time to go hunt vampires. And so they proceeded to do it. Right. And it was hilarious and I loved it. But like what I definitely felt like I didn't know what kind of rules to impose here. Like what can I add to say like, okay, you're stumbling around drunk around town late at night, hoping to bump into a vampire. Whereas as DM, I know that, yes, indeed, there are vampires in this town. So what should I do? What would you do in this situation, Dan?
Well, that's really interesting. You know, normally my first instinct would probably be to grab the first edition rules actually and start modifying ability scores, immediately regret it. and say, yeah, you've got a couple extra hit points and your attacks have gone down. Deal with that. And your dexterity has gone down, so your AC sucks too. That's probably about, you know, from memory, I wouldn't look it up. That's probably about the first thing I would do. I see in the chat that Joshua is, thinking that's maybe not the best mechanic. Giving penalties would make the players unrealistically abstinent, which is a pretty great point. But I don't think about this a lot. I could very well be caught flat-footed on this, but that's the first thing that would pop into my mind, admittedly.
Yeah, I was certainly flat-footed by it at the time. You know, and just looking just now, kind of thinking off the cuff here, I noticed there was a comment in the chat recently. See if I can find it. Where? maybe you could get it up on screen for me if you can find it. But William posted that the PC skills and abilities go down, but the character thinks they're going up. And like
that's good.
Getting William, you're getting more into the realm of what I'm really looking for. That sounds great to me.
That's so good.
Like I kind of want to, and unfortunately, this is one of those things where you can only get away with this once, right? And then the players know that you're gonna rule it this way, and then they're gonna look at you sideways. But like I would love to do something like, great, you're drinking this alcohol, you all get a bunch of temporary hit points. Your hit point pool goes up. Here's an extra 20 hit points for each of you, right? And then let them go out and do stuff. And then when it becomes relevant, when somebody says, oh, I'm down to 18 hit points, I go, yeah, I lied about those 20 hit points. You don't actually have them.
Oh,
let them get in a little over their head and then just be like, oh, sorry. It turns out it was all in your head. You just thought you were awesome.
You know, the writer Keith Amon, who we've had on a couple times, this always sticks in my head. He's like, I think there's a point where how do you deal with like social skills, the players failing social skills? And Keith's boldface advice is lie to the players. Just flat out lie to the players about what their observations are. That's how to represent like the players being fooled by something. And I'm like, okay, that's all right. That's a hardcore gaming mechanic that could work.
Again, the downside here is you can only get away with this once because the next time they drink and you go, you get 10 extra hit points, they're going to go, those aren't real. Right. But I would very much enjoy doing that because that sort of feels like, right? I want to give them the confidence to go get into the trouble than they should.
Yeah.
And then rip that out from under their feet and go, nope, turns out, you know, you're just under the influence of this drug.
I'm perfectly fine. I think that's great. The Dan completely proves this message. And I would also say, you know what? As long as you have a little bit of churn in your players, you know, if you just have one new player, I bet you could probably hook the new player in next time. possibly the other players either might go along with it, or they might just not be believed if they try to prevent it.
Yep.
I bet you could do that more than once.
I mean, it makes a nice real world situation too. Like, especially if it is a new player, then you get you could get the other players being like, oh, I'm an old seasoned veteran. I know I'm not going to get drunk tonight, right? I know where this is going. You go ahead, lad. You go ahead and enjoy yourself.
Now, I suppose this brings to mind, like, that many of us like using the alternate carousing rules, that after a session, you go and you gamble a certain amount of money, basically, in a slightly abstract fashion, go carousing and then have possibly some benefits of experience, or randomly have some bad experiences that then wind up generating more encounters in the game. I've tried to hold that at arm's length, and I've seen it have such great results. It's really hard to say no to it.
One of the nice tricks that the carousing table does, which you could do for inebriation or influence of any drug or alcohol, right, is that effect of, like, you black out, and then the GM advances the clock and says, you come to in this state, right? And now you have to back figure out what happened. Like, one of my favorite entries in the carousing table that hit very early when I first started using them is I had one player who says, you know, who in fact had just obtained very fancy armor. I can't remember if it was magic or not, but it's certainly like full plate armor that he'd been working hard to obtain. And the result the next day on the carousing table was you wake up the next morning naked in the public fountain in the town square. Right.
Great.
And so, right. So it was really nice. A, it's socially embarrassing to him. Well, my character's, you know, naked in public, and obviously, you know, everyone in town knows what he was up to. But also, where's my armor? Where'd that go? Right. And I'm not a fan. Let me make this clear. I'm not a fan of stuff on the carousing table that just takes, or any effect that just takes stuff away from players. I don't like that. When I got results like that of, like, the players lose magic items, the players, right, wake up naked, whatever it is, the first thing I did as DM is sit down and go, well, where is it, right? It didn't vanish into the ether. Yeah. It's somewhere else. So immediately decide where it is, who has it. Because that's going to become the player's objective, right? Okay, who's got my armor? What happened to it? Let me track that down.
Generally, this is a lesson that I learned that I had to get educated through a hard lesson, is even aside from, lose equipment and the players become like bulldogs about that. But even aside from that, if I have like a random table of crazy stuff, I'm going to have to like back it up with like where this is coming from, because frequently the random stuff that I thought was just chafe is far more interesting to the players than the stuff that I actually prepared. So almost inevitably I'd go to random stuff table and the players like, this seems much more interesting than, you know, the dungeon or whatever else we've been doing. We need to find out more about this. We need to find out more about this young girl who can prophesy the future, but grows older every time she does. We need to know about that. That's a really good instinct. If you have a random result, to immediately start thinking about backing it about what is the story and where is the stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I had a great instance of this where I had players. One of the things I like to do is, especially I encourage them, if they were going to do the carousing, that we do it at the very end of the session. That way I had a whole like week in between to come up with what happens and what's the end result. Right. And we had one case where a player, I think they rolled some result on the carousing table that said that they like fell in with a secret cult or something like that, right? They gained connection to some secret society. And that player happened to be absent the next week. And so I knew what happened to them. I had the result on the table. No one else knew at this point what had actually happened to him. And the player was absent. So I just decided, well, I'm just going to hand wave this for now. He's missing. The next morning, you all get up, you come down for breakfast, he's gone. You're not sure what happened to him. Well, the players, you know, even though at the time I'm like, cool, this is just a nice way for me to sideline this character for a session and not worry about the fact that the player is absent. No, the players jumped all over that. We got to figure out what happened to him. We got to find him. We got to, right? And so we then have an entire session that had nothing to do with any of the plot lines that had happened before that were all like, we got to track down our missing comrade. And I had to come up with reasons for them to fail because they couldn't succeed because the player wasn't here.
That's fabulous.
Fabulous. So then I was like, okay, well, I know he got inducted into some kind of secret cult, so let's invent stuff about that cult. And then the players start uncovering information about this cult and how terrible it is. And they find its headquarters, right? And it was great because, frankly, it serendipitously ended with them invading the cult headquarters. And at the very end of the session, they break into their room and they find him chained to the wall and delirious.
Great.
And then we got to pick up there next session. And then I got to tell to the player who was absent, well, sorry you were absent. Here's where we're starting this session. You are strapped to the wall. headquarters, and your friends just busted down the door. Good luck.
That's really, really great execution. I think that DMs really need to be prepared to entirely improvise an entire session. I've had to do that like at a convention. And that is part of the game, and you get, I don't know what your DMing level is once you've gone off script and had to improvise an entire game. And then frequently the players go, oh, that was a great gaming session. Oh, that was one of my favorite. That was one of my favorite sessions. It's pretty common reaction.
You know, to back that all out into a strategy, I would say if I had a campaign where the players enjoyed this frequently, right? Not just once off in a blue moon, but the players decided it was funny for their characters to get fall down drunk every night, then I would probably want to start to invent like some series of tables of like, where do they wake up the next day and in what state, right? So just some random elements that I can toss in there and be like, okay, these elements now need to be included into the part of the night they don't remember.
Yep. Now there's a number of things that I want to get into the hour here that I'm really interested in. And let me pitch one. Places where the drinking is actually critical to the adventure itself, because a couple of these pop to mind. Again, maybe more commonly in early adventure stuff. In a lot of us really like the basic D&D module before the Lost City. And a major part of that whole campaign is that there's this lost underground society, all of whom are entirely addled out on drugs. And so every single time you meet any of these underground people, they're lost in a hallucinatory world. They're wearing strange masks. They probably think that they're like, they incorrectly think that they're animals or something like that. And so the whole milieu of Tom Moldvay's Lost City is very much in this kind of dark fantasy. I'm thinking Lovecraft, I'm thinking Howard. The entire society is all strung out on drugs, actually, and it's a major part of what you're interacting with, which is kind of interesting. Of course, mythologically, in any society, particularly the Norse, you might want to pull up the image of that has a red dot on it. You know, one of the things that comes to mind is the Norse fable of Thor, when he goes with his friends to the fortress of Utgard-Loki, who are giants, and they set Thor up with illusory challenges. And one of the three is, Thor, can you drain this drinking flagon that's pictured here in this horn? And he drinks and he drinks and he drinks, and he actually is unable to empty the horn. And then what it turns out after the fact is that they had magically connected the horn to the ocean. And so when they walk away, they look at the beach and the ocean has visibly lowered by like a foot. So he did, he was unable to actually drain it, but that's good. And he actually drank a visibly significant part of the ocean. There are, you know, some myths that say that Odin lives on wine alone. And so again, this kind of hooks up with the whole berserker culture of the drinking and the offering of drinks and the result of it. And can you succeed at it? can potentially be really critical elements to adventures. And the thing, again, in basic D&D that comes to mind is there's a module that I'm really big fan of, module X10, Red Arrow Black Shield, I believe, which is a continent spanning epic war. And the players are try to form a coalition of willing nations to confront this massive horde invasion. And it's a combination. There's role-playing, and there's dungeon adventures, and there's negotiation, and there's wargaming, and it was made to use battle system for your miniatures battles and things like that. And also Menser's War Machine. So you go around, and the players are trying to have a negotiation session with the leaders of each country to get them into the coalition. And sometimes it's like a battle of champions, or sometimes you have to go get the magic whatever of leadership. But one of the northern countries that kind of, you know, has Scandinavian type culture, you get there and the king is just like having a big feast. And that's all he cares about. He's like, oh, why fight? Why be angry? Eat, drink, and be merry. And if you want my alliance, the only way you can do that is to win a drinking battle with my chief drinking henchman. So out comes an enormously experienced, enormously, you know, fat NPC. And the only way that you can get this army in your coalition is that one of your PCs has to win a drinking competition. And they have a paragraph or two of rules for that. But basically the entire the entire state of the D&D known world ultimately boils down to, can you drink more than this other guy? And if you can, you save the world. That's what it comes down to ultimately.
It definitely seems like the drinking competition trope is definitely something you want to be prepared to have rules for.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Now I think this is a case where maybe ability score damage or like saving throws versus poison or whatnot, you can definitely, I feel like I can definitely emulate this one with some pretty easy rules there of just like, you're just going to keep making these checks. It's going to be at some kind of progressive penalty, and it's your stat versus their stat, and let's start rolling, and you'll have another drink.
Exactly. That's all you need. It works well. I think it's a nice scene, honestly.
You know, but also then I think you want to be prepared for inevitably when, much like Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think, right? Doesn't that one have is that the one that has the drinking competition? Right, that inevitably the tavern gets attacked after the drinks are had, right? And so somebody is completely hammered and having to deal with an emergency situation. You want that.
You know, actually, just last night I watched the 2021 The Suicide Squad. Totally has that scene, 100%. It's a nice scene, honestly.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of the things. Do you want to talk about your campaign? So one of the things in the description to our event here on YouTube is potentially talking about actual players, not characters, but actual players who are at the table, you know, somewhat under the effect, possibly, again, you know, taking the beer and pretzels game literally.
Sure.
I will confess it's actually not something I think about. I'm actually pretty bad, honestly, at identifying people that are drunk or under the influence. I kind of have a little bit of a blind spot about that. So what observations do you have about that, Paul?
I mean, there are some games, there's sometimes where you see this, like, I've been to conventions where, yes, it's beer and pretzels, right? People have beers at the table and it's no big deal. But then inevitably, if this is a con and you're at the table for 8-12 hours, right, playing games all day and you've had a few beers, inevitably maybe somebody has a few too many, right? And I know that I've anecdotally heard of it was a Cthulhu tournament at Gen Con where, it was one of those things where in each round there is a winner. So they run, you know, I don't know, let's say, you know, 50 games of the first round. And each of those games has one person who gets to advance onto the second round. Right. And so then you have, you know, 10 games because you have, you know, you've coalesced all the winners into these games, right? And it funnels up into this very end point. And from what I remember of this particular game is that the final game of all the winners, the handful of people who won, it became very LARPy, and it was held at a bar that was all, you know, decorated to look old-timey and Cthulhu-esque and interesting and whatnot, and they served actual drinks. And that was part of it, was that you had to role-play your way through these scenarios and hold your liquor, because it was drinking. That's kind of an extreme of it, right? But I've also I can also say I played a game in college where we just wanted to experiment with that and thought it would be like, what's it like? Let's spend the night drinking and let's play D&D and see what the effect is.
Right?
And maybe part of it is like we're already a little tipsy as we're sitting down to the table, and then maybe we'll throw in a mechanic of like, okay, if this happens to you, you have to take a shot, right? That kind of thing. I will say my experience, so I don't know, I can't really talk about the Cthulhu game. I've only heard about that one secondhand, and I've heard players, you know, talk about how amazingly immersive it was, but also how it was difficult to get through, because by the end they were starting to feel the effects of the alcohol, and they were still trying to, like, you know, win this tournament, but also, you know, hold their liquor. In the experience I had in college, I will say it wasn't great, frankly, right? That, like...
Okay.
D&D requires a certain amount of focus, right? Role-playing games requires a certain amount of focus. And when everyone at the table has lost that focus, it becomes incredibly difficult to keep the game going.
Okay.
So I would say probably D&D is not a great choice for this. Now, there might be other games that would be more fun. For example, I bet it would be super fun to play a game of Fiasco Drunk. That sounds great. And and I've anecdotally heard of people playing that game while under the influence. And yeah, it's a little more wild and weird, but, like, again, there's less to hold on to other than just the storyline, so as long as everybody's hooting and laughing and having a good time, then, you know, all's fair, I suppose.
And to be perfectly, very interesting, to be perfectly clear, right, it's not something that I would personally recommend to anybody in public, just to be clear. You know, frankly, if I was, to be perfectly honest, if I was in a tournament structure and I found out at the end that the last session required drinking, I would actually have to decline, frankly. I'd have to back out of that myself.
Certainly not. By surprise is terrible. Right? This is a major consent violation there, right? Like,
Yeah.
At least in the game I played in college, at least, like, it was what we set out to do, right? We said, okay, as a group, we are going to agree that we are going to see what it's like to play D&D while drinking. Right. And the answer, and frankly, I'll tell you, like, the next day, as we all compared notes, we were all like, yeah, that wasn't great. Like, we should have either drank or played D&D.
Yep.
One of the two. But trying to mix them, not so good.
I feel like it's probably a good thing to experiment with that in a safe space, that everybody's supportive of each other and everybody agrees with that. I think it sounds like about as good as you can possibly do with that. Now, I will also say that I have seen, I have, you know, playing Book of War, my indie war game session, I have seen people do better with a couple drinks, Ulysses Grant style, I guess. They got more aggressive. They took more risks. Frankly, they got more aggressive. They hit me harder, faster than I expected normally. So in a couple circumstances, I actually have seen people play the war game a little bit better than they did previously, actually. So that's something to possibly take into account. That seems to be what the play looks like, right? You tend to get a little bit looser, I mean, literally, and tend to be a little bit more, take a little bit more risks in, you know, that happens. Like, that's what the deal is, frankly.
I think William hit the nail on the head here with this comment of GMing is already enough like herding cats without drunk logic involved.
Yeah.
And right. So, like, first of all, let me say, even if you're going to intentionally sound like we're going to play D&D drunk, I don't think the DM can participate. I don't. DMing drunk just sounds terrible. It's just a bad idea, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Want to play something? If you're going to play a role playing game that involves alcohol, I think you want something incredibly rules light, probably improvisational. This is why I'm leaning towards Fiasco, right? Something that is improvisational, doesn't require a GM. Everybody can participate. Everybody can have a good time and enjoy it. Because, being like the one sober person who's trying to corral the group of people under the influence, not the most fun experience in the world.
I'm going to say from experience,
Yeah. So I can't say that I recommend that.
Now, let me throw out that... Yeah. Go ahead.
Go on. Oh, I was going to say that, like, the other potential difficult social situation, especially, and I see this happening at a con, especially at a late night game, is dealing with the thing where you're running games where somebody is coming away from, like, oh, we just, you know, we were just at a party, we were just at a, you know, whatever.
Right.
And we, you know, and so we're stumbling to the game already under the influence. I think that's kind of like worst case scenario, right? So now you're like, I'm trying to run a regular serious game or whatever. It doesn't have to be serious. I'm trying to run this game and I expect all my players to be focused and ready and capable. And one or two of the people at the table are in fact drunk. Now they're just a major, you know, roadblock to everyone else's fun. And I think that's an unfortunate situation that I can't imagine seeing happening. And frankly, I guess I wouldn't feel bad as GM of that game to saying, just getting to a point saying, look, you two, you won. I'm sorry. You're clearly not capable of playing this game right now. I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. You might need to do that. I saw a case on Stack Exchange RPG of ongoing campaign, regular group of players, and one night one of the players shows up completely drunk. The DM doesn't quite have their radar up, isn't totally aware of exactly how incapacitated they are, and plays the character completely out of style. So a character that previously was restrained and cautious that night goes completely lunacy crazy, attacks someone they shouldn't, and the character gets killed. The character is dead as a result in this long-running, otherwise careful campaign. And then after the fact, this DM was asking, what do I do now? Do I retcon, you know, do I just leave it like that with this unexplained, why did the character go crazy in game? I'm having trouble in game making sense of what just happened. It's totally broken the immersion of the campaign for all the players. So do I just let that happen? Do I come up with an in-game rationale for why that happened? Do I retcon it and say that session never happened? And, you know, among the suggestions were, you know, do one of those things, let the event stand and say that the character was possessed. Say that night it was a doppelganger that had temporarily taken their place and you can recover the original character or something like that. So clearly a difficult situation. They would have been better either, you know, being aware of it, canceling the session, saying that particular player can't play that night or something like that. It was clearly a very painful moment that they were trying to deal with after the fact of actually a PC dying as a result of the player being drunk that one night.
Yeah. That's a tough situation. I don't know. I think at that point, like I can't come up with like a general rule or advice for it. I think it's a thing you need to sit down with that person and have a talk, right? Like the GM and that player need to discuss and say like, hey, this is weird. What do we do about this? Yeah, and I think, you know, again, like, I think that it gets into very gray, just, you know, social politics or like whatnot, right? Like, it's just a bad scene, mm-hmm. I think. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about D&D or any activity. If some of the people are showing up under the influence and others are not, it's just not.
Yes.
Right. I think, I don't want to be the person who's saying like you should never play D&D drunk. For me, it wasn't a great fit, but I can see the idea of like other role playing games or other games maybe are a better fit for you know being a little tipsy or whatnot. But you've got to set expectations from the beginning, right? Everybody's got to be all in. You have to say like, yep, we all agree we're going to sit down, we're going to have a few drinks, and this game's going to be wacky as a result, and we all agree that sounds fun.
I will confess, like I would, it's certainly, again, as someone who's not a big session zero guy, I wouldn't think to set those expectations in advance. So me, I would have to be ready to think about what to do on the fly the first time it shows up, because I would never think to mention it beforehand. And I think we all agree that, you know, the one person showing up intoxicated is a much worse situation than everybody talking about in advance and being communally doing the same thing.
Well, Dan, we are just about out of time here. You have any final thoughts on drugs and alcohol in your role-playing game?
I think, I kind of wish that I'd used it more deeply than I have. And again, thinking about Elric, thinking about dark magic and things like that, slightly surprised that it got that it was in first edition and got scrubbed afterwards. I kind of like these Monty Cook rules. I kind of feel like that's something that a player can dig into. If there's a risk, there's a reward. There's an addiction rule there. That I would possibly start playing with, maybe again, change the ability score modifiers to some other effect. So I would definitely think about using that more, again, in a campaign that's a little bit darker oriented, which is perfectly fine. Something like a Warhammer milieu. And drinking competitions are a major part of mythology. I've seen that, you know, to really good effect in certain campaigns. So I would certainly support having that all that in game. And me personally, I am not going to propose that someone actually shows up at the game actually drunk. That looks like that's just a recipe for a lot of trouble down the line. And I would certainly say don't do that unless there's an agreement on what the social situation is communally.
I totally agree with that. For me, I still like, ultimately, I think this is an area that I want to think about a little more critically before it shows up in my game. I want something better than ability damage. I just don't like it. And I want something that applies social pressure. So I'm trying to think of something that it behaves a little bit more like a charm spell than anything else, you know, to take a little bit of the player agency away when they are under the influence. Right, I want something that's going to encourage them to do things more than just their own amusement, right? More than just their own amusement, something that's going to mechanically encourage them to say, yep, my character should take bigger risks, should do dumb things because they're under the influence of this substance, whatever it is. Unfortunately, at the end of this show, I don't have a brilliant idea of what that is. So viewers, let me know if you have ideas of better mechanics for inebriation, better mechanics for addiction, please share them with us here in the comment section of the YouTube video. I'd love to hear from you. Help my game for sure. And maybe if there's enough meat there, that's something that Dan and I can revisit on the show.
Definitely. We'll look forward to that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're the Wandering DMs. We're on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and GitHub and places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please smash that like button. Yeah.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files at our website at wanderingdms.com. Just hit the podcast button. Or you can find us through various podcast carriers, such as iTunes or Spotify or Stitcher. If you're on one of those sites listening to our show and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, like Paul said at the top of the hour, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see our different tiers. Every single tier, including the $1 one, gets you access to our private Discord server with a conversation about gaming and D&D and fiction and modeling and wargaming is happening around the clock 24/7. Look for other shows coming up this week. I'll be back on Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for more of Dan's Old Time Mini Show. And we're currently doing science fiction miniatures, duplicating lead miniatures from the Star Frontiers game from the 80s. And next Sunday, we'll actually have back one of our favorite guests on the channel. We're going to have Mr. John Peterson back. That's Sunday, June 30th. And of course, John is renowned in classic D&D circles, and he's the writer of Playing at the World. He was one of the main writers of the D&D art book. And he's also one of the executive producers of the upcoming official D&D documentary movie that's planned to come out this summer for the 50th anniversary of D&D, along with the director, Joe Manganiello. So we are really looking forward to having John back on the show next Sunday and getting to talk to him about his lot of projects he's doing this year for the 50th anniversary, including the official D&D documentary movie. So please join in again next Sunday.
Excellent. I can't wait to see John again. He's been on the show in the past. Always a fantastic guest to have. So very much looking forward to chatting with him.
I am really excited about having him back, particularly this summer, as a matter of fact. So, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So, please, we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.